Blog Talk Radio.
Edition. Today is May 16th, 2015, and we want to welcome you however, wherever, and whenever you listen to the show. We are happy to have you here. We have a great show for you today, 90 minutes on tap, three fantastic authors, so you can be able to sit back, relax, or whatever you do when you listen. I can't tell you what to do, but you're going to enjoy the show today, and we're going to kick it off here with our first guest. His name is Jonathan Papernick. We're going to jump into John Connell, and then Alan Topol will end the show. So without any further ado, here we go. Let's hit it to our first guest, Jonathan Papernick. His book is called The Book of Stone. It is available now. So, Jonathan, thank you so much for coming on. How are you doing?
I'm good. I know it's hard to believe that my name would actually be Papernick. It sounds a little bit Dickensian and made up, but it is not a nom de plume. My real name actually is Papernick. So, yeah, that is the name I was born with.
And it was really funny because I was actually watching a little soccer this morning before I jumped on, and there was a guy, and his name was called Drinkwater. And I'm like, I've never seen that before.
Oh, there's some good names out there. Growing up, I thought I had a terrible name, but it suits me now. So
that's good. And, you know, so this is your latest book is called The Book of Stone. And this is actually what your first, I guess you want to say, full-length novel that's not short stories, because the other couple books you've had, There Is No Other, and then you put out another one, The Ascent of Eli Israel, and you had other stories. So
yep.
This is kind of your first novel, right?
I would say so, yeah.
Yeah. So why don't you go ahead and give us the behind-the-scenes look into The Book of Stone?
You mean the process behind putting it together or what it's about? I started writing the book a million years ago, actually in September of 2000, when I was living in Brooklyn at the time. This is before Brooklyn became kind of gentrified and hip. I was living in this neighborhood where you would hear gunshots every so often going off. It was pretty scary. But I started writing this book. I knew I wanted to write a novel dealing with kind of religious extremists, and I knew that I wanted to have a character in the novel who was this larger-than-life judge who had been disgraced. And that was sort of a reaction to the fact that my father, who was a lawyer, was trying to become a judge at the time in Canada and was having no luck. So I kind of wanted to create this monstrous character that would show my father, at least, that, hey, you're not missing out on that much. Being a judge does not mean you're some kind of saint. It's not necessarily going to make you a better person. So I spent several years kind of struggling to write this book and kind of got nowhere. And after a few years, I got through about four drafts of the book, and I kind of pretty much gave up on it until a year ago. I was approached by a very amazing editor who forced me to answer difficult questions and pushed me to raise the drama in all situations. And the book came out really quickly, that last draft. And I think it's more timely now than it was back in 2000, because it does deal with this idea of a secular person, kind of a loner, kind of adrift, who gets drawn into this extremist movement and participates in a major terrorist attack. So I think it ties in a lot with what's happening with these Westerners joining ISIS, or with the Boston Marathon bomber who was just sentenced to death yesterday. These people that you would never imagine being capable of such monstrous things. So I wanted to get behind the psychology of what it is that makes a terrorist, how one becomes this way. So it's as much a psychological study as it is a thriller, and I think I pulled the two things off rather nicely.
Yeah, without a doubt, the book is, you want to stay more relevant today, because the way that the world is going on today, I mean, everything is just so, I guess you want to say, just so unpredictable. You just never know what's going to go on from day to day. But when you sat down and you decided that this is what you're going to do, you had to start doing a lot of research. Did any of this research take you into any kind of places that you kind of felt uncomfortable? Did you meet people that you were just kind of like, wow, you know, what is going on, and anything like that?
Well, in some ways, my research had already been done for me. My first book of short stories, The Ascent of Eli Israel, was based on the time I spent as a journalist living in Jerusalem in the mid-90s. And that was when I first kind of became aware of these kind of radical people, you know, when Yitzhak Rabin was assassinated, or there was the massacre in Hebron when a Brooklyn doctor machine-gunned, 30 or 40 Palestinians to death outside of a mosque. So I was not really aware of these sorts of people prior to my time in Israel. I would meet them around. I mean, I had a roommate who was one of these kind of guys. He wanted to join the army so he could kill Palestinians, but he was not a citizen, so they would not allow that. I wrote several stories in my first collection that dealt with extremists, but I still felt, the call of this subject matter. I was still obsessed with it, and I wanted to kind of explore it on a broader canvas and on a much deeper level. So, I did some reading, a little bit more reading as I went on, but the basic foundation was already there, and that was kind of part of the reason why I felt comfortable enough to sit down and write it, knowing I had a bit of a foundation, because writing a novel is a major commitment and of years, and I felt I already had a certain foundation I could work off of.
Yeah, and that's one thing that you just said that I hope a lot of, younger authors and people that are trying to write, it's a huge commitment. I mean, look how long it took you to make sure that you got it done and you got it right. And a lot of people today just kind of throw it out there. They don't edit it. And then they say, well, Amazon will just publish it for it. Well, yeah, because Amazon doesn't care. But when you take the time and the effort to make sure that you get everything right, I mean, how often were you kind of going back and changing and moving things and making sure that everything was kind of in the right places and the parts were all working together?
Well, I would say in a major way, I did six significantly different drafts of the book where I was changing scenes, characters. But as far as changing, word choice, sentences, cutting out paragraphs, I was doing that constantly. Even in a first draft, I'm always trying to make the language as sharp as possible. I know you're not advised to do that, but I just can't sit with a bad sentence if I think I can make it better. So it was kind of an ongoing process. And I think one of the challenges of writing a novel is that you must be obsessed with it. That must be the number one thing in your mind. So when you were walking around doing other things, shopping for groceries or in the shower, your subconscious is still working on the book. So you're always kind of there, which kind of is difficult in the sense that it makes you a little bit absent from your ordinary life with your friends and family.
Mm-hmm. And let's get into, let's get into Matthew Stone. I mean, who's the character? If you were to sit down and you were to maybe talk to him and somebody coming up and says, well, who is this Matthew Stone guy? How would you answer that?
Well, I would say he's a very, very troubled character who wants nothing more than to have his father's approval. He's never been able to achieve that, and his father had kind of put him down for his entire life. And now that his father has died, he feels one last opportunity to make good in his father's eyes. His father has left behind 36 boxes of his books, and he's underlined and annotated the books. So Matthew feels he has a chance, kind of a pathway forward to redemption. So he hopes to do that. He's a very messed up person. I mean, he's suicidal. He burns himself with cigarettes. He has issues with his mother who abandoned him when he was younger. So he wouldn't really be in the psychiatrist's diagnostic manual. Whatever he's got is sort of his own thing, kind of a cross section of issues.
He burns himself?
He feels that burning himself with cigarettes kind of takes away the pain, or at least gives him some element of control over the pain he has, that he can cause it whenever he wants and remove it whenever he wants. And I think that's consistent with somebody who is in so much pain that he has that sense of control there.
I have to say, I mean, I've interviewed thousands of authors and thousands of books, and that's the first time I've ever heard of a main character and protagonist actually burning himself. You have got to be the first one I've ever heard that of. That is amazing.
Well, it did come to me one night. I remember.
Character.
He's extremely complex. I mean, I tell my students all the time that stories don't come out of effective stories don't come out of language or plot. It is out of a believable psychological portrait of a character, and all the rest comes afterwards. So I remember waking up one night in Watertown, Massachusetts, when I was living there, and the idea just came to me. He burned himself with cigarettes. And I went through that night, and I changed it throughout the book, and it just kind of added that extra layer of depth and texture to him.
Yeah, and that's the one thing that when you're writing a book, a lot of people, again, a lot of new authors make the mistake. I think they focus too much on the plot, maybe the running around and the scenes, but they forget about the complex part of the characters that will actually help create scenes for you just by the type of person that they are. Do you think that that was kind of helpful to you when you make Matthew such a complex character that when you're writing scenes, it almost makes it a little easier just because you know exactly how the character is going to react in certain situations?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it was the author Bernard Malamud who said that if you write with enough confidence, your characters will recognize that confidence and start to show you their tricks. And after a certain point, yes, they are alive in your mind. I mean, these characters are as real to me as a friend I haven't seen in 5 years. You know, you can still imagine them doing things, hear their voice. So, as you get towards the end of the book or past the midpoint, they start to suggest things that you wouldn't have known. It really is kind of a mystical process or a meditative process, you know, writing a book, creating a world, creating people. It's rather amazing.
Yeah, and when you're writing a bunch of short stories, and of course, you know, this book was probably filtering in your head a lot and going around, how much of the short story kind of aspect did you take with the Book of Stone to be able to kind of master this and get this into a full-length novel?
In writing the short stories, I certainly hone my own voice. I know what type of story that I write. I mean, most of my stories have a certain darkness to them. I think the language is usually lyrical but clear. I think my characters are most usually troubled. They have challenges in getting what they want to get. And so, I just channeled that on a much larger scale to the novel. It was familiar to me after I got deep enough into it. By the time I got to the fifth draft, I felt like I knew what I was doing. But before that, I really didn't have a clue. I was kind of writing in the dark, and that's a terrifying thought, because once you've spent several thousand hours on a book that sucks, it's like being in the middle of the ocean. It'll be just as hard to swim back, so you got to go forward, and that's what I did. I couldn't have lived with myself knowing I put in all that much time and ended up coming to nothing.
Yeah, and that's another interesting point is, you know, when you're writing something down and even though you write something down and you know it sucks, it's still important, I think, to just keep getting the words out because you can kind of massage them and kind of get them all around later. What was the most difficult part then of you writing the Book of Stone?
Well, the early stages were impossible, and that was for several years. I mean, I knew I wanted this book to be more explosive than my first book. I knew it wanted it to make The Ascent of Eli Israel look like Disneyland. You know, I wanted to write the kind of book that would shock people and make them think. And I just didn't know how to get there. And my prose was just off for several years. The character was flat. I didn't really know how to streamline my plot. I had a lot of, I kind of followed my writing in all kinds of directions that didn't lead anywhere. And I have a better sense now that nothing irrelevant to the story should be in there. And one scene should lead to the next, and there should be nothing at all, not a single word or image out of place in your book. So I don't think I really knew that when I sat down to write the book initially, but I have a much clearer idea now that there needs to be a unity throughout the piece.
And I want to remind everybody that we're speaking here with author Jonathan Papernick. You can go to johnpapernick.com, that's JONPapernick.com, for more information, of course, on this book, The Book of Stone, and everything else that you've written. And the one thing that if people go in and they look at your past, they're going to see that you have, you had some very interesting path, I guess, to get where you are now. Let's kind of talk a little bit about when you were a journalist over in Israel in the 1990s and everything that, you know, was going on at that time, which was a huge uproar. How was that kind of grooming you for, you know, doing what you do now?
Well, I've always seen myself as a fiction writer. Ever since I was in second grade, I always saw the world in the retelling as a fiction writer. But I did think, for whatever reason, that being a journalist would kind of help that, and I could maybe make a career as a journalist and write together. But they don't really work together. It kind of takes the same energy. I didn't really have the skills as a journalist. I may have been the worst journalist in the world as far as the day-to-day reporting. It was just, I was an intern for the United Press International and for Associated Press, but I covered, you know, the Palestinian election, the very first one they had. I covered the election where Benjamin Netanyahu won the very first time. I remember going to bed that night and seeing, you know, that he was going to lose, and I woke up the next day and the newspaper said Shimon Peres wins, but he did not win. It's one of those kind of Dewey wins moments. I covered suicide bombings. There was a whole wave of suicide bombings when I was there. So, I mean, as a fiction writer, it was invaluable. It was also invaluable as a journalist, realizing that being a reporter was just not my thing. And I love teaching. That's sort of how I make my living now. I love teaching fiction writing. I think I'm as good or better at that than I am at writing. But, you know, reporting was just very challenging for me. I think I like to take the time to craft things, you know. And you can't really do that when you're trying to get a story about a suicide bombing out.
Yeah, that's for sure. I mean, writing fiction and, of course, journalism, I mean, it gives you the basis to be able to write and, you know, maybe research and do those kinds of things. But fiction writing is definitely something that is all imagination. I mean, it's something that you have to, you sit over, you cultivate, you let stew, and then it just finally be able to come out. And I think a lot of authors, even very, very popular authors, are becoming a lot, too cookie cutter. It's like the same book over and over, just a different cover. And that's something that you probably made sure that you did not want to make sure that happened. You wanted to be something that was totally different.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I want the experience to be fresh. I don't read cookie cutter books, or if I feel like I'm reading one, I put it down. You know, I want to read the kind of story that I want. I want to write the kind of story that I want to read. I mean, as Elmore Leonard said, you know, when you're writing, you cut out the parts that you would skip over or where you would fall asleep or put the book down. So, you know, I wanted to make sure that I was on my toes at all times as well.
And again, the book is out now. It came out May 12th, so it's really new. I mean, we're talking 4 days old. How has the reception been? How have you been able to get those early reviews and everything back? And were you a little nervous when it came out and you were like, oh God, what's going to happen now? How is that feeling?
Yeah, I'm nervous because it's something that means a lot to me, and I think it is a book that if people give it the chance to actually read it, I think it'll really touch them. But, you know, there are so many books coming out at all times. I mean, I had three or four colleagues that published a book the same week as I did. So the question is, how do you find space on a bookshelf? How do you get readers? How do you get reviews? The few reviews I got before the book came out were all excellent, and that was gratifying. You know, I'm doing a book reading on average, like one out of every three nights for the next 6 weeks. I'll be in Mystic, Connecticut today at 6 p.m. I'll be in Brooklyn at Greenlight Books on Monday. I'll be in New Hampshire at Water Street Books on Tuesday, Brookline Booksmith in Boston on Wednesday, and then I'll be in Portland, Maine on Thursday at Longfellow Books. So I'm going to be around a lot trying to get out there and meet people. You know, I read to a full house at the Harvard Bookstore 2 days ago, and it was really gratifying. People really took to it. And, you know, if I can keep up like this, you know, you have to kind of go out there and bang the drum for yourself, because nobody's going to really do it for you.
Yeah, and now how on your tour, how much of that did you set up on your own, or how much was that the publisher setting it up?
I pretty much set up the whole thing myself. They were taking care of reviews, advertisement, editing, setting up other sorts of things. There's the Book Expo. They set up some time for me there, Book Expo America in New York in a couple weeks, meeting with the Jewish Book Council. So they did a lot, but they're pretty much a startup right now. And I knew that I would be able to put together an effective, and this is, you know, my East Coast book tour. If things go well, you know, then there'll certainly be an opportunity to do the rest of the country. But I knew I could hit this up pretty fast. There was about five or six bookstores that I already knew people at or had some connection with. So I thought if I could just nail those down and build a tour together, I can get it down pretty fast. So I did that. In the months leading up to the book, you know, I just wanted to be proactive, and I was.
Yeah, I think a lot of authors don't realize how much they actually do have to do on their own. Publishers today are not like they used to be 25 years ago, where they would take care of these book tours and send these things out because they had control over, you know, the books and how they were going out. So I think that what you just said was extremely important for people to hear, that you had to take things on your own and figure out your path on what would work for you in order to make you feel comfortable to go out there and get your book out. And how long did you kind of have to sit down and figure this out, map it, and say, this is kind of the strategy that I'm going to use?
It took about 6 weeks. And it was more complicated than that, because I've got a former student whose book came out the same day as mine, and she would not have written her book if it wasn't for me. Way back in 07, I encouraged her to turn this into a novel. So I wanted to set up some dates so me and her can read together. And then a friend of mine from graduate school also has a book coming out in a few weeks, so I'm doing a few readings with her. So kind of not just organizing my readings, but trying to pair up with other friends to make it fun and worthwhile. So, I mean, this should be a really fun bonding experience with some people that I really care about. So that I'm looking forward to that as well.
Yeah, you're talking road trip here, aren't you?
And they're amazing writers, too. I mean, my student, Sarah Novich, her book, Girl at War, I think is going to be huge. It's set in Croatia during the war in Yugoslavia, and it's quite powerful. So to share a stage with her is going to be really exciting.
Now, of course, your book is a lot more in-depth than just the regular running around chasing the serial killer cat and mouse kind of game. Did you have some kind of underlying moral? Did you want the reader to get something out of this more than just sheer entertainment?
Oh, absolutely. I wanted the reader to identify with the protagonist, as broken and disturbed as he is, and to desire what he desires, which is actually a rather horrific act. And at a certain point in the book, once they have identified with that and are kind of pulling for him to redeem himself, to kind of pull the carpet out from under them and realize they have kind of consented to a monstrous act themselves, which kind of illustrates how easy it is for us to kind of get sucked into consenting certain acts of violence. I mean, you know, consenting drone strikes. I mean, that might have been unthinkable 10 years ago, and now it's happening. You know, there's all sorts of things that we as ordinary citizens have been, you know, coaxed into accepting, which may otherwise have been unacceptable.
Can you give an example of what you mean by that?
Well, like, for example, drone strikes. I mean, I think there's a lot of sense, instead of sending an entire army into northern Pakistan or something like that and causing a world war, the U.S. government is sending in drones to kill off, you know, Taliban-type people or al-Qaeda people or what have you. But on the other hand, hundreds and hundreds of civilians are being killed in that, and the majority of people don't even raise an eyebrow about that. So they're essentially consenting to such a thing as that. I'm not saying I disagree with it, because I think having a full-blown war is worse, but it is ugly, and there's a lot of ugly behaviors that we as citizens consent to, either through our silence or otherwise.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think that the way that everything is gone now, I'm always so afraid of, you know, all this violence is just creating more violence. I don't really see anything getting any better. I just see things getting worse and a lot more, and I think down the road it's going to be a lot more worse. And so I don't know if you kind of sense that same way, and it sounds like that, you know, your characters in your book kind of massage over these points and how things were in the past and how things were in the future. I don't know if we're any better off than we were in 9/11. I don't know.
Well, I mean, 20 years ago, I was pretty sure we were on the cusp of a real viable peace treaty between Israel and Palestinians. I mean, I really thought that was going to happen. It seemed inevitable. Once the economic benefits came in, I thought it would be impossible to turn back the tide. But clearly terrorism and violence worked there in undercutting that, both assassinating the prime minister and the Hamas wave of suicide bombings. Those two things worked. So terrorism works. The people who committed that horrific act on 9/11, it worked. It didn't shut down America, but it changed America. We have the Patriot Act. We have the surveillance program. The country spent over $1 trillion on military adventures. Thousands of American lives lost, tens of thousands of Iraqi and Afghan lives lost, opening the door for ISIS to fit into the vacuum there. So, you know, terrorism does work. And that is kind of a terrifying thought, because it is difficult to really kind of tamp it down sometimes.
Now, are you thinking of writing, of course, Matthew Stone as a series? Was this a total standalone future hold for you and your writing? What are fans going to be able to see from you in the future?
I'm working on a very, very, very different book. It doesn't have any kind of thriller or suspense aspect to it. It's about a men's Jewish softball league at a synagogue, and kind of dealing with the collapse of the synagogue after losing all their money to Bernie Madoff, and how this community is kind of in crisis. And it's lighter, but it's also kind of deals with the depth of a number of characters. I think I'm going to have multiple main characters instead of just the one as I had in this book. I've never really written from multiple points of view, so that's really my first serious attempt to do that. And I also have another, you know, book in progress that's in my drawer right now about a con man who sells the Brooklyn Bridge. But you know, I've done about five drafts of it, but I think I'm going to have to put that one on hold for now. I don't want to write two cynical novels in a row, so I'm going to do the synagogue one next.
Gotcha. So basically, you know, you're kind of. You're not sticking into one genre. You're writing what you feel and what your heart is where it's taking you at that time.
Yeah, I never really was much of a thriller reader until a certain point I realized I was writing one to a degree. So, you know, I read some John le Carré, and I read some, you know, this great book by Neil Gordon, The Gunrunner's Daughter, and a really good book, Moth Smoke, kind of a literary thriller by Mohsin Hamid, who won the Booker Prize for his next book. Yeah, I mean, I think I can write anything, any style, if I kind of, you know, give the attention to it. But this book just felt it needed to have that breathless quality to it in order for it to really work. You know, like there's a ticking time bomb waiting to go off.
Well, we got about a minute left. What I want to be able to do is I want to be able to let you kind of have the last word and let people know about your social media and everything else that they can get in contact with you. So it's all on you.
Yeah, well, you can find me at Jonathan Papernick on Facebook. Twitter, I think I'm Johnny Papers, or the late Johnny Papers, I'm not sure which. And you can find me on Instagram as well. I think it's also Johnny Papers, J-O-N-N-Y Papers. Instagram is really fun. I've just discovered that in recent months, and I've been enjoying that. Yeah, and I tweet a fair amount. So, yeah, Twitter is a good thing. If anyone ever writes to me and wants to engage with me, I'm always happy to respond. I never ignore anybody, generally speaking. So, I like to talk to other people and engage with ideas and thoughts.
Well, John, we want to thank you so much for coming on. It's been a pleasure to have you. Looking forward to seeing what you got coming up in the future. Again, the Book of Stone is out now. Make sure that you visit. You can go to Amazon and buy the book. You can also go to John's website, jonpapernick.com, for more information on all that. So, John, thanks for coming on, and it's been a pleasure.
Thanks so much. Take care, John.
All right, bye-bye. So again, everybody, that was John Papernick, and the book, again, is called The Book of Stone. Make sure you go check that out. So have some other things that we've been telling you about for years, and that's Kensington Books. And they bring out some of the very best thriller and suspense books, including these new ones to make sure you check out. You have Christine Trent, and you have The Morning Bells. You have J.A. McKavitt with Killer Gourmet. Born of War by Anderson Harp, and Final Breath by Kevin O'Brien. You can visit KensingtonBooks.com for more on these titles and all others. Also, author Brenda Novak, every year she does this great thing for diabetes, and she needs your help. And this year she's changed it up. She not only puts together an auction that she takes all the proceeds, over $2 million that she's raised now for this, and sends it to the Diabetes Institute, Research Institute, but this year she's put together a limited edition book collection with, again, all the proceeds going to diabetes. So please, please visit Brenda Novak for the cure.org. That's Brenda Novak for the cure.org, and check out this great cause. Believe me, you will not be disappointed. The books are fabulous. You got cookbooks, and I think things are signed, so make sure you go check that out. Finally, are you ready? Because thriller master David Morrell has just written the sequel to his award-winning book, Murder as a Fine Art. Yes, that's right. Thomas DeQuincey returns, an Inspector of the Dead. So see why everyone is talking about these two books, and visit davidmorrell.com for more information and get yourself caught back in 1860s London. We are going to take a short break and be back with our next guest. It is John Connell and his book, Ruins of War. So make sure that you stick around for that one.
All it takes is the perfect shot. You can take your shot this year in New York City during the 10-year anniversary of Thriller Fest. Take aim during Craft Fest, Pitch Fest, Thriller Fest, and new this year, Career Fest. All designed to help you hit your mark. Meet the pros, like 2015 Thriller Master Nelson DeMille, Silver Bullet recipient Kathy Rikes, with spotlight guests Greg Isles, Charlaine Harris, and Mark Billingham. And let the best help you zero in on your career target at the Grand Hyatt in New York City, July 7th through the 11th, 2015. It's time. Take your shot. Register now. www.thrillerfest.com.
Welcome, everybody. After the break, we want to thank you again for joining us here on the Suspense Radio Inside Edition, May 2016. Make sure that you check out SuspenseRadioNetwork.com for information on all the shows that we have here on the network. We will not be here in 2 weeks. We will be back in actually 4 weeks on Inside Edition, but all the other shows will be going on. So May 30th, we will not have a show. Things are going on. Won't be able to do it, so we will not be live that weekend. But now we're going to jump right into our next guest. His name is John Connell. You can see John Connell in this month's edition of Suspense Magazine as he was CW Reader's Corner author. His book is called Ruins of War. So, John, thanks so much for coming on. How are you doing?
Good. Thank you. Thank you for having me on the show.
So let's just jump right into it. Like we said, you were in the ITW's Reader Corner this month. You talked about your favorite books, but now we're going to talk about Ruins of War, which is your latest one. So let's take that behind-the-scenes look. It's a new Mason Collins novel. Tell us about the book.
Okay, it's the first in the series with Mason Collins as the protagonist. Ruins of War takes place 7 months after Nazi Germany's defeat. It's in the city of Munich, which sustained at least 70% damage or was destroyed, and Mason Collins is a criminal investigator for the U.S. Army, and he has to hunt down a psychotic killer in the ruins. And what I like about Munich, it was the burned-out shells of buildings because they had firebombed it, so it was very spooky. And so you can imagine a Jeffrey Dahmer or a Ted Bundy let loose in a city with 1,000 places to hide and 500,000 easy prey. And the killer, he selects his victims at random. He butchers them. He tortures them, then butchers them and leaves their bodies in ritualistic displays. He doesn't leave any evidence. There are no witnesses. So Mason Collins has his hands full trying to track down this killer.
Yeah, well, you set the book, of course, back in 1945.
Right.
And so you have basically no technology.
That's what made it fascinating.
Right.
I'm sorry?
Yeah, which is a good thing.
Well, yeah, it was great. It was a challenge in a way, but at the same time, I was fascinated to put Mason in this kind of situation where not only is it there aren't cell phones, there aren't computers, there's nothing like that. Also, Germany had sustained so much damage that a lot of the records of the citizens, of anyone that he might consider suspects, they were either destroyed, burned, or lost in the chaos. And I also like to put Mason in the situation where here's a city that is under martial rule, basically, by the American occupiers. But there is just very few methods to discover that the Germans themselves were resentful of the American conquerors, and the Americans were resentful of the Germans and distrustful. So there was all of this other stuff brewing while he's trying to investigate these murders.
And now, was World War II something that you had always been fascinated by, and that was the reason why you picked 1945 instead of picking, of course, you know, you could have done World War One and many other places. What was the pull for you to pick this era to bring it out?
Well, it's true. I've always been a World War II buff. I'm kind of in that late first wave of baby boomers after World War II. So it was always something that was sort of in the American psyche at that time, especially as a kid. So I've read tons and tons of books and, of course, the movies, personal accounts of soldiers, which I found the most fascinating. And I'm not an historical expert, but I think I know quite a bit about the lead up to war and the war itself. But it was while I was, it was another book, an earlier book that won't see the light of day, where actually Mason Collins was the antagonist. He was the killer. And I found him so fascinating, and his presence, he had such a magnetic presence, that I decided to make him the protagonist. And in his original backstory, he commits murders in American-occupied zone of Germany, and I started reading about that, and I was absolutely blown away by the circumstances after the war. And I'd never really studied that much. You know, you assume, yes, there was destruction, there was some deprivation, there was the threat of Russians on the border with 60 divisions and that sort of thing. But I had no idea the extent of deprivation, the extent of damage, the extent of the chaos and the crime that was going on. It was just an incredible backdrop, and I thought, this is perfect for crime fiction.
Mm-hmm.
So
let's get into it then. Mason, you know, you kind of changed who Mason was. If Mason were to be sitting down, you know, with us right now, we're just sitting there talking to him, what kind of person will we find out he is?
Well, he's trained to kill since he was from his training as a cop and a soldier, but he likes to use his wit and intelligence more than his brawn. I would say he's mostly a loner. He tends to be a loner, at least, and a bit combative. And I think that if you got on his bad side, you'd want to kind of step away. He has a pretty short fuse, and some of the things that I brought from him as being a killer, he also has quite a dark side that's only kept in check by a strict moral code. So as long as you're on his good side, you're okay, but you piss him off and you better back off. So I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, finish up.
Okay, well, I was just going to say that's what really attracted me when he was the bad guy, was just this, anytime he was on the page, my attention certainly would go to him. So I thought, okay, this sense of danger and this magnetism that he has just really attracted me. So I think, you know, he'd be an interesting guy at a bar.
And I think that's the part that people are going to, they like to gravitate to. They get into the character. Of course, the story has to be intriguing enough and it has to move forward. But when you were sitting down, of course, it sounded like, and it sounds like that Mason was kind of the first guy who was kind of brewing in you, and then you kind of started to figure out how you were going to get him into a story, and this has kind of worked out. So was it that way? Did the character kind of come before the plot?
Yes, absolutely. Like I said, I was sort of investigating his backstory, and that's how I discovered post-World War II Germany, but he was also a bad guy in another story that I'm going to revive and put him as the protagonist in that story as well. So there were a bunch of story ideas that already were kind of lined up when I decided to write Mason as the main character, which kind of helped in a way because I was able to jump into book two as soon as I turned in book one to Berkeley. So that helped. So I've got this momentum going. So, Mason was always first, and I think that's what's important in a series anyway. It really is the main character, and I've been attracted to him, writing about him. So I envision this whole series of books with him.
And now, do you have any idea of, you probably don't think of an end of like, okay, I only want to do 3 Mason books or 4 or 5. This is just going to go pretty much until what? Until you figure I'm done and there's no more to tell? Was that your plan?
Yes, I think so. As long as I can keep it fresh, as long as I can keep the stories interesting, I kind of would like an overarching arc of his character over a series of books. And I think as long as I can keep him very interesting, and, you know, keep everything going and fresh, then, yes, I'll keep going because I think it's a lot of fun. I've been attracted to historic fiction, the books. Written 3 other books before this one, and they're all historical fiction. So I really enjoy this period, and I want to take Mason to some of the craziest, most dangerous places in Europe and the Middle East during that time. It was just a very volatile time. A lot of change was going on. So mm-hmm. There's plenty of material to work with, too.
And I want to remind everybody that we are speaking here with author John Connell, and the book is called Ruins of War. You can go to johnaconnell2ls.com for more information on that. Make sure you hit the A in there. So johnaconnell.com for more information. And the one thing, you know, we have something in common. I don't know if you know this, but we both grew up, and I know that you weren't there for a long time, but we're both sort of from the suburbs of Columbus, Ohio. I grew up in Gahanna.
Oh,
I'm not sure where
okay.
you were from.
Well, from what I understand,
where
it's called. Someone I actually ran into somebody the other day, and they said, "Oh, that's Clintonville." So I was awfully young. It was around Chatham Road and North High Street, and that sort of Whetstone Park or Recreation Center. So that's Clintonville, I assume.
So you were close.
Yeah,
to
I was there.
Yeah.
Yeah, we started in. I was born in Atlanta, but I was not. Much more than a year old, and my dad went up to Dayton, Ohio, and then just about a year and a half later, we moved to Columbus. So I was there until I was in the fourth grade, I believe.
Okay, yeah. So you spent a little bit of time, a little bit of schools in Columbus, and then you got out.
Yeah.
Like somebody who's very smart leaving Columbus. That's a smart thing to do. And you finally
wow.
you got yourself out and went back to Atlanta.
Yeah.
And the one thing that's because I'm always fascinated by. The bios and the backstory of the author themselves, because it tends to lead a lot to what type of writer that you're going to be. And you were fascinated by studying psychology. You wanted to know about the human spirit.
Right.
You kind of got involved in that. So tell me, why was what was with the fascination? How do you think, you know, your background led you to believe because you are very much a character-driven person when you're writing. So you're thinking about all those things. So how was your background able to kind of get you into that mold when you started thinking about becoming a fiction writer?
Well, I think I've always been fascinated with other people's lives and what they think. I remember even as a kid, as we would drive down the street, I was always curious of each house, what those people were thinking, what those people were like. And I think that's that fascination with how other people are and how they think, what makes them up, it led me to psychology. And so I've carried that on into the storytelling. So that's what I enjoyed a lot, studying the psychology of the serial killers, which was a great. Also, because there is a connection to the Nazi medical, the Nazi doctors that performed horrible human experimentation in the concentration camps, there are a couple of books about the psychology of these people. And I was fascinated mm-hmm. by that, the psychology of the survivors of the concentration camp. So I really enjoyed researching that kind of thing. So
yeah, and then the other funny thing that is that, of course, we came from Columbus and moved to Los Angeles. You moved to Los Angeles.
Yeah.
You know, you're kind of not there anymore. So we kind of, and, you know, I'm interested in the human psyche. We're almost brothers. I kind of feel this connection with you.
Well, that's very nice. Yes.
and now,
yeah,
and a lot
I moved.
Of, and, yeah, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say yes. We moved all over Ohio, then New York, and then D.C. My dad was a professor of architecture, and he wasn't quite satisfied with each place. But he would go to different universities. We ended up in Atlanta, and that's when I, in my 20s, I decided to get in the film business, and that's why I moved to Los Angeles to get in the film business.
And this is you know, your debut thriller book. This is the one that you kind of put out, and this is, you know, so you probably had a lot of, you're probably very nervous. You had a lot of things going on. So when the book finally came out, and it came out just a little over a week ago, I think it was May 5th, that the book hit the street.
Right.
How was it? Did you be able to finally take a breath? Were you able to kind of relax, sit back, and then now you're enjoying this process of having to speak with people like me?
Well, certainly I'm enjoying that process of talking about the book, because I think to be a successful writer or someone who maintains perseverance, you have to have the passion. So I love talking about something I'm passionate about. But no, I didn't take a breath. Actually, I started the promotional process before the book came out. So it's been actually, and it's another part of being a writer that I had not experienced before. So it was sort of like going from 0 to 60 pretty quickly, where you have to then put yourself out into the public, which was something quite different for me. You know, most writers are alone. I'm in a darkened room when I write, and then all of a sudden, boom, you're out in the public. Your book is out there, and people, you know, one of the things that I love is that people react to the book and either enjoy it or not. And so it's a very interesting process, but the promotion is kind of, I've been kind of at a full trot since the book has come out. So, but it's been great.
Yeah. Did they give you, the one thing that you weren't really familiar with was having to promote yourself, market yourself, get out there, talk about your book and your work. Did the publishers, did they give you a lot of direction? Do they kind of help you find your way? Do they help you ease us into it? Or is a lot of it done on your own?
Most of it was on my own. I did a ton of research. Of course, I bought a bunch of books about marketing and promotion and the things to expect once the lead-up to the launch of the book and the launch itself. I did a lot of research online and talked to people. With Berkeley Penguin, I have an in-house publicist, but I also decided that this is my one shot at getting a book, getting the attention, because discoverability of a new writer is very challenging. I hired an outside publicity firm as well, just to get the book spread as far as wide as possible. So a lot of it has been on my own. The big houses tend to, for new writers, there's a certain focus or traditional focus of promotion, and all the social media and a lot of the outreach is really kind of up to the author. So that was a big learning curve.
Yeah, that's one thing that I try to let everybody know is just when you write the end, that's actually the beginning.
Yes, it is.
You've got a lot, you know,
indeed.
It's a long road ahead to get to the point of where you, whatever success goals you've set for yourself, for your writing, of where you want to be, that's the day one that you have to start that.
It's a whole other world. I'm enjoying it. Like I said, I'm passionate about the book. Ruins is War is a lot of fun, and I think a lot of people have reacted very positively with it. So that makes it easier, but I haven't done any public speaking since I think I was a junior in high school. So that part was, had to get it going pretty quick.
Yeah, and were you doing, I guess the thing is, how was the journey going from trying to find the publisher? Did you have an agent first? Did you go directly to the publisher? How was that journey for you?
Oh, yeah, if you're going shooting for one of the major publishers, to go through an agent, or I guess you don't have to. You can send it into their slush pile, but it could sit there for years and never be discovered. But really, the way is to get an agent. So actually, my path was a little different. I wrote, book three, which will not see the light of day, I sent to an independent editor. He ripped apart that book, but he did it in such an interesting and intelligent way that, and he complimented my writing, and he encouraged me to keep going, but he said, don't do this one, forget this one. And I was so impressed with the way he handled it that I sent him this book, Ruins, and he loved it. He had lots and lots of notes, which I appreciated. And so then he said, okay, this is great. How about if I contact some of my agent friends and we'll get it started that way? And so I credit him for a lot of the help in getting an agent. I probably could have done it without his help, but it would have taken much longer. So he kind of accelerated that process. And then the agent, took him about 4 months to get a book deal, publishing deal. So,
wow. And then you hit Berkeley. So, and now you're off and running.
Yeah. They picked that book too, which comes out in February. I was very pleased about that. And I'm busy on book three. So we'll see.
And now you're doing stuff in the ITW. Are you going to be a Thriller Fest? Starting to go out and go to some conventions?
Yes. I will be definitely going to Thriller Fest. I can't wait. And I'll be on the debut writers breakfast panel. That's a great organization. They've been so helpful. They're just great at promoting new writers. Lee Child in particular has been great. As a matter of fact, I'll be on Blog Talk Radio Next Steps with Jenny Milchman, and I will be a guest, and Lee Child will be the guest, so I can't wait for that. But they've been so supportive. They've been fantastic.
Yeah, that's what, and of course, we go to Thriller Fest every year. We'll be there this year again for the magazine and the publishing and doing all that fun stuff. Yeah, it's the organization that I think a lot of, and I don't know, how did you find out about it? Because we've kind of found out that a lot of publishers don't really maybe tell their authors about this and these opportunities. How did you kind of get involved with them?
Just doing stuff online for those years that I was writing books and sending query letters just to get rejections. I did a lot of research, and I think that's what I would encourage any writer that's really looking for a publishing deal to do, is just to learn as much as you can about the business. And I just came across them online a number of years ago, and it was always kind of a dream to be a member of this great organization. And so once I had the publishing deal, I immediately said, hey, I'm here, you know. So they
signed me up for free. And that's the thing, it's free.
Yeah.
It's freaking free,
I know.
People.
Yeah, I know. That's amazing. Yeah. I'm a member of the Mystery Writers of America as well, and the International Crime Writers as well. So those are great organizations. But I was really pleased that the International Thriller Writers was there for me. And that's one thing some people have asked, what is the biggest surprise now that you have a book deal? And I would say it's that writers are so supportive of each other. They're really, despite the brutal competition out there, most writers will reach back to new writers. And I've been very pleased and happy about that. So.
Yeah, that is what you know, you're all trying to get the same reader, but you're all in the same boat, so you all help each other. And I think that is one thing that I do see from, you know, a lot of authors is there's enough readers for everybody to be successful, to be able to do their thing. And the one angle that you might have a little bit is, you know, do you have any kind of European stuff that you're doing? Seeing as how, you know, you spend a lot of time, of course, in France, you're over there, your book is set in World War II. It's right in that area. So do you have a lot of interest from the European market?
Well, actually, Germany bought book one and two, which I was pleased and honored that they did, because I don't portray some of the Germans very nicely. You know, they're not in a great light, but I think they were attracted by the fact that there is a story of I do portray the deprivation, the absolute chaos, the black markets, the life at that time. And one of the biggest publishers in Germany bought both books, so I'm very pleased about that. Yeah, so we're in trying to get the rest of Europe to be interested in it. I think I'm hoping France and we'll pick it up, but we'll see.
Yeah. Well, I said, we got about a minute left here in the interview. So what I want to do is I always like to make sure that you have the opportunity to let everybody know maybe, like, you know, like I said, like where you're going to be, places they can find you, all your social media stuff, all that fun stuff. So I will now leave it into your hands.
Okay, great. I have a Facebook page. It's John Connell on Facebook. I have a Twitter, which is at John A. Connell. I also have, as you mentioned, my website. I will be on Blog Talk Radio, as I said, on May 27th with Lee Child. Jenny Milchman is the host of that, and I'll be at Thriller Fest. Mysterious Books bookstore in New York is having putting the book in a book club, which is cool. But
nice.
There you go.
So you're getting it out there, working the pavement, man. That is fabulous.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And being on your show, this is fantastic.
Well,
I really
there
appreciate
we go.
This.
Yeah, you got me first. I don't know if this is the first radio interview you've done for the book, but it's been great.
Yeah, good. Yeah, I've really enjoyed it. Really, really appreciate it.
Yeah. Well, hey, again, John, wishing nothing but the best. We want to thank you so much for coming on. It's been a pleasure to speak with you, and we'll see you in July.
Yes, we'll see you in July.
All right. Have
Thanks
a good day.
Thanks very much. Okay, you too.
All right, bye-bye.
All right.
So, again, everybody, that is author John Connell, and make sure you go to johnaconnell.com for more information and pick up the book Ruins of War, available now. Wherever you buy books, you will find this one. You will also find a couple other little things that we have here, and that is that Mary Burton returns with her book called Be Afraid. This USA Today best-selling author has readers on edge. Fear of the unknown is terrifying, but the truth can be even worse. And this time, a cunning madman will leave no survivors. So pick up Be Afraid on Amazon or wherever books are sold. And finally today, Robert Kadira brings the first book in a new series called Red Gold. Best-selling author Vincent Zandre calls it a thriller packed with deceit and danger, but also compassion. So Red Gold kept him up all night. So visit Robert Kadira, KIDERA.com, and buy the book on Amazon or wherever books are sold. So we are going to take another short break because I need to take a drink and a breath. And we are going to be back with our last guest of the show. His name is Alan Topol. The book is called The Washington Lawyer. So you can sit there and listen to all of this as you wish. Be right back. So welcome back, everybody. After the break, we want to thank our past guests for being on. Of course, we had John Papernick on with The Book of Stone, and then we also just had John Connell on with Ruins of War. Now we're going to finish up this in the legal suspense genre. His name is Alan Topol, and his book is called The Washington Lawyer. This is his 11th full-length novel. So we want to welcome Alan to coming on to the show. So, Alan, thanks so much. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thanks so much for having me, John.
The book came out in March, and it is called The Washington Lawyer. So let's just dive right into it, and tell us, what you got going on in this one?
Okay, so here's what I don't have going on. I don't have any courtroom scenes. It's not one of those legal cross-examination kind of thrillers. Forget it. This is a book that opens with a naked woman on a beach in Anguilla. She's a congressional aide, former model, who's gone off with a powerful U.S. senator, head of the Senate Armed Services Committee. Something happens to her that weekend over Veterans Day on the beach. And she has a twin sister, Allison, who's determined to find out what it is, what happened to her sister. And Allison's a real digger. Into the mix comes a powerful Washington lawyer, Andrew Martin, who happens to be considered to be on the short list to be Chief Justice for the Supreme Court. Martin is a very, very close friend with the senator who took the model to the beach in Anguilla. And so that is the genesis, and that's what gives rise to the conflict. It's Allison squaring off with this powerful lawyer, Martin, to find out what happened to her sister. It's Washington corruption. We have some Chinese spies, and it's very much of a different kind of Washington novel, and that's what the mix is, John.
And what was the reasoning behind? Why did you decide to kind of maybe go a little more, bringing in a little bit more moving parts than just making the legal thriller and the whole thing? What was your reasoning behind it?
Okay, well, for me to start with, this book is a departure, because my last 10 books have all been international geopolitical thrillers. That's what I've been interested in. That's what I've written about. I wrote a book, The China Gambit, about China's rising military power, The Spanish Revenge, about conflict between Christians and Muslims in Western Europe, The Argentine Triangle, about Argentina's history and dirty war. And I've been a lawyer in Washington my whole career while I've written these 11 books. And I said, finally, I would like to write a book about Washington. And so for me, it was none of my other books had anything to do with law. Hey, that's my day job. I don't want to write about that when I write at night. Mm-hmm. But I did want to make a departure from the international and delve into Washington, because we have such marvelous things happening here that the rest of the world, you can't believe when you read about them. I mean, of course, there was the Menendez indictment recently, but think about it. Senator Kennedy of Chappaquiddick, Wilbur Mills, some people may remember, was dating a stripper when he was a powerful head of the Ways and Means Committee. She gets out of his car at midnight naked and jumps into the tidal basin. We have all these wonderful things going on, and I decided to try to capture them, because my first goal is to write an entertaining, fun book, and then second, to say something about our town. So that's kind of what pushed me in that direction, John.
Gotcha. Yeah, because looking back, of course, everybody, you can go to alantopol.com, alantopol.com. And that's the one thing, I guess, that jumps out is when you click on, you know, your books tab and you see your past books is, of course, they're all set in, you know, different parts of the world. And then, and so now that you decided to finally come back home, I guess, so to speak, how was, I guess, the thought process or the difficulty in kind of coming home? Because like you said, it's something that you kind of do every day. So were you doing something to make sure that you didn't get bored with, you know, with kind of doing something like this just for your own satisfaction?
Yes, no, I had to be. And, you know, it was very tricky doing it, navigating around. Also, I've been a partner in a large Washington law firm, and and I have very, very close friends, and I'm still affiliated with the firm, and I didn't want people to say, hey, he's writing about so-and-so, and he's writing about, because that wasn't my intention. I wasn't trying to repay any debts or obligations, but I was creating my own characters. But that was a tricky thing to navigate, but a couple of things have really made me feel good about it. The first is the Washington Post on the front page of Style C1 on Monday when the thrillers are reviewed by Patrick Anderson many Mondays, gave this a full-length review starting on the front page of Style on March 16th when it came out. Very favorable review. I felt good about it. We have a prominent bookstore in Washington called Politics and Prose, Serious Bookstore. They've invited me to come in and talk next Saturday. The National Law Journal did a big feature about lawyers writing fiction that sort of profiled me. So I feel that the risk of getting out of, and as you know, talking with a lot of writers, it's a risk when you've been writing in one kind of genre and form, and when you depart and go in a different direction, it's still a thriller, but it's not an international thriller. It's always a risk, and you sort of hold your breath and say, am I going to lose my readers? And I've been very, very pleased with how it's come out.
Yeah, and now that you're 11 books in, you've kind of been able to find your voice. You probably, you know, worked on certain things, you know, going back, if you want to kind of go back to, you know, the 4th of July War and the things that you have written, you know, in previous and after that, and now coming up. Do you still find yourself working on a certain aspect of your writing, something that when with every book you say, I want to make sure that this is stronger than it was in the last book? Do you still ask yourself those questions now that you're kind of 11 books in, or do you just kind of have it down that you just kind of know when you're writing down that it just starts flowing?
No. It's the story for me. The stories are always flowing, and I start, fortunately, with a long outline, a 50 or so page outline, and I'll start with, I write out different character descriptions so I can understand the characters. But the part for me that I really try to focus on and make it better and better is characterization. Because, I mean, you know, when I started off, that maybe wasn't the strongest part of my writing. And so I put in a lot of time and effort. For example, the young woman who's kind of the protagonist of this, Allison, the sister of the one that ended up being in the beach in Anguilla at the beginning of the book, I worked hard to make Allison a credible, acceptable, believable character. She's a professor of archaeology. As the book opens, she's off in Israel in a dig when she finds out something happened to her sister. She's very athletic. She'd been on the U.S. field hockey team and Barcelona Olympics, but I worked hard to refine her as a character and the childhood that she had growing up, because, you know, I've learned over talking to a lot of readers, and we were talking at the beginning, I like to go out to bookstores and do book signings, not where I make a speech, but where I'm there 2 or 3 hours, as I'm doing at Calabasas, as you said, later in June. And talking to people, I've kind of realized that one of the things that they're very, very interested in is being able to identify and root for the characters. I mean, that they say, well, look, you know, yeah, that was a good book, but I really didn't like any of those people. I didn't find myself rooting for those people. And so I've really worked hard to try to give the reader characters that they can both identify and root for, and hopefully that works with Allison Boyd in this book.
Of course, when everybody sees, you know, you've written so many books now, and I guess you call it your Craig Page series, of course, the question always comes up as, well, you know, should I start with this one, or should I go back and read the first? How do you kind of answer that question? Well, you know, where do you kind of direct people to go if they're just finding out about you and they want to get involved in the series? Where do you tell them to start?
Well, see, it's kind of interesting. What's happened with me, John, is I actually wrote two books, The 4th of July War and A Woman of Valor. The 4th of July War dealt with the U.S. energy crisis, and a powerful department, the head of Department of Energy, came to Washington. And I was, as you say, sort of finding my voice of what I wanted to do. What I wanted to do was write entertaining books that people can turn pages and stay up late at night reading, but on the other hand, had something to say so that they come away and say, hey, I learned something from this book. I wasn't just entertained. For me, that's important. And it worked with the 4th of July War. So then I did a book called The Woman of Valor about a young Jewish woman whose family was expelled from Egypt in 1956. She goes to Israel. Her father's broken by the experience of what happened. She becomes active in the anti-terrorist intelligence with the Mossad unit and ends up falling in love with an agent, and they chase a terrorist. Much different. Then I took a break from writing because we have 4 children who were in various stages of growing up, and I found I could, hey, be a father and a husband. I could be a lawyer and a writer. I had all of those 3, but I could only do 2 of them at the same time. So until the last one went off to college, I didn't write any more books. Then the last one went off to college, and then I wrote 4 books, different international issues. Spy Dance deals with Saudi Arabia. One dealt with Syria. One dealt with Japan. And, again, moving in different areas. Then I wrote a book called The China Gambit, and I created a character, Craig Page, because I was concerned with China's rising military power, which, by the way, is the single biggest threat to the United States right now. It's not the Middle East. It's not Europe. It's not Russia. It's China. But so I wrote this book, and I teamed up Craig with a young woman by the name of Elizabeth Crowder. And what happened was, as I was getting to the end of the book, I really liked Craig and Elizabeth as a character. And so in my first 6 books, I never repeated a character. I stayed away from that whole series business. Each time was a new operation. But then I thought, well, wait a minute. Hey, Craig's a good character, and Elizabeth's a good character. And I worked hard creating these characters. Why do I want to toss them away? And I felt badly. I killed a character in an early book, and I resented. I came to rue that because I could have used her again. But at any rate,
yeah, write it as a dream.
Yeah,
write it as a dream and bring her back.
I did. Yeah, I'm still working on that. I'll find a way around it. But at any rate, so I said to myself, well, wait a minute. Hey, I like these characters. Why not continue them on and do the kind of series thing and see what happens? So it worked very well for The Spanish Revenge, the one about Christians and Muslims in Europe, and it worked for a book called The Russian Endgame, involving Russia and China on the world stage, and it worked for Argentine Triangle, keeping Craig and Elizabeth alive, although their relationship went through torturous periods of time, because that's a little tricky. You have to develop their relationship, and then what happens with him and other women. And okay, I could deal with all those things. But after 4 Craig Page books, I was beginning to think, I want to take a break from Craig Page for one book. I'm going to come back to Craig, and my next book that's coming out next March, called The Italian Divide, does have Craig and Elizabeth back. But I wanted to take this one book change, departure, and this idea, this Washington book, had been floating around in my mind over years. And I'm sure, with other writers, you've heard a similar thing. In fact, when I talk about it from time to time in our household, it became known as the sisters' book among my wife and my daughter and me. We knew it as the sisters' book. It was Allison and Vanessa. So I said, that's it, a one book break from Craig, and I'm going to do the sisters' book, which became, of course, The Washington Lawyer, which is a lot better title than the sisters' book, I think. So anyhow, that was kind of how I got to this one.
So yeah, so kind of back, like full circle, when you finally kind of bring this out and then you sit down and you start reading these things, do you feel to yourself, do you think that you've written your best book yet, or do you still think that it's coming?
Well, that's funny because I used to think that there were kind of 2 books that stand out, and I'm working with some people out in Hollywood on on two of the books, and, you know, working with is a euphemistic way to saying I'm participating in all that discussions that so far hasn't gotten anywhere toward getting something
exactly
on the screen. People are hopeful. You know how that goes. But anyhow,
oh, yeah.
So but my two earlier books, the two that really got these things, the second book I ever wrote, The Woman of Valor, I've had so many people say, that's your best book. And then I wrote a book called Spy Dance, which became, although it was 20 years later, it was my third book. And people said, well, that's your best book. And I sort of felt, well, maybe that was my best book. But then I had a funny thing, is because the publisher I've been working with, and that's kind of an interesting story, because I did two books with William Morrow, and then I did four books with Penguin. And now I'm with Select Books, which is a small publisher, been in business 14 years. Kenzie Sugihara is the publisher, a very savvy guy who'd been with Random and some other places in a high-level position. And he's a high-quality nonfiction house, and I'm really his fiction author. But so he read the book, and he said, look, on The Washington Lawyer, he said, I have to tell you, Alan, this is your best book yet. And I felt really, really good. And then I gave him The Italian Divide, and he said, Alan, I think this is your best book yet. So I kind of think, I really think, John, that writing, if you stick with it, I think you can keep trying to progress and kind of making progress. And so I like to think I'm still on an upward curve, at least I hope so, with respect to perfecting skills, because you begin to see things that you didn't see before. Now, you know, we all know there are quite a number of good writers that we look at their work and we say, gee, their early stuff was amazing, but, you know, their last few efforts weren't nearly in the same category. So I'm sort of wary that that's, you know, might happen, like with wines at some point where they just go over the hill. But I don't think it's happened yet, happily.
Well, do you think that that happens because authors become complacent? Do you think they become bored? Why do you think that that would be? You would kind of think that the more that you would write would be becoming more polished. Now, of course, I always go back to Stephen King because I think that he's the greatest writer of my generation. And, you know, he's had some duds. He hasn't had winners all the time. So why do you kind of feel, you know, why do you think that sometimes that does happen, that their earlier stuff is really, really good, and then, you know, their later stuff, you know, doesn't really live up to it? Do you think it's complacency? Do you think they just get too comfortable and they don't really strive any more like they used to? They don't have that hunger anymore?
Well, I think there are two factors. I think one factor is, probably a number, but two that stand out with me. One is that if particularly ones who tend to be very prominent often don't take very well to editing or to suggestions because they think they're too good for the editors. And, you know, and so you pick up a book by a prominent author and it's 620 pages and you say, well, wait a minute, where was the editor? Why wasn't this 480 pages, which could have done the job much more effectively? You begin to think, well, maybe the editor, the writer wasn't willing to be edited. So that's one thing. The other thing that happens is, you know, when you stare at that blank page every morning and you've got to come up with creative ideas to push into, to make work for a whole novel, it's just, you know, it's taxing. And at some point, perhaps, the writers are, for whatever reason, nobody understands the creative process, are simply the newer ideas, the more recent ideas that they're developing aren't as creative as the original ideas. They're sort of, you know, on a downhill trajectory on their creative ability to fashion a story. The craft is there, no question about it. The craft is there. But at the beginning, in our business, it's you say, what are the three most important ingredients to make something in this genre? You say it's story, story, and story at the beginning. And if you don't have a story that's going to grab somebody, then, you know, you're going to be in trouble. And I think that's probably part of the weakness, John. Does that make sense to you?
It does, because, see, my theory, and I lay some of this on the publishers, and the reason why I lay some of this on the publishers is the fact of, what, like, because we have a publishing company, we have Suspense Publishing, but the one thing that we never do with any of our authors is give them a deadline. We never say, okay, we got to have this book by March 1st. We got to have this in. Because to me, that hampers the creative process and it makes it feel too rushed. It's like a painter. It's like, you know, they need to look at it. They need to know what's going on. A musician, a writer, a sculptor. If it's rushed, maybe the Statue of Liberty doesn't come out that way. Maybe they're like, we got to have this deadline. So I think that sometimes it needs to be cultivated. It needs to be brewed. And if it doesn't happen in a year, maybe it takes 2 years. But I think with the thing that the sales and the business side and the money that publishers are always pushing for, because it is a business, and we don't forget it's a business. It's not for fun. Otherwise, all these things would be for free. I think that hurts a little bit, because once you've written 25 books in a series, is it really fresh anymore, or is it just the same book because they know that they're going to get the money for selling it? And I think that's part of the reason that I see a lot of them and I get bored, and I don't really read that many series that long. I just don't. I'm a standalone kind of guy, and I've said it 100 times. I'm a standalone guy. I like the fact that you have to stare in front of that blank screen every time and think of something instead of 50% of it kind of already being written for you.
Oh, that's a good point. That's a really interesting point. And it ties into something else that you said with the writing process. And that's, it really helps, I find, to put, this is consistent with your deadline point, to put the manuscript down for a month or 2 months.
Yeah.
Don't pick it up. And then come back to it and look at it cold. And the other thing, which ties into the editors, where if editors are good, I once had an editor on one of my books called Dark Ambition, and the editor was at Penguin. And the book had, when I gave the manuscript to my editor, he said, I love this manuscript. He said, it's terrific. But he said, I mean, there's no good way to tell you this, Alan, but your ending's just terrible. I mean, it's like the book falls off a cliff when it really the fireworks should go off.
To be honest, it's good to be honest.
He was a good editor, but he said, I'm not going to tell you how to fix it. That's your job. So I had my day job. I was a lawyer in Pennsylvania Avenue office. I go running along the reflecting pool toward the Lincoln Memorial at lunchtime. I come up to the pool, and I see the Statue of Lincoln, and I start to think, hey, you know, this would be a great place to put the ending, and here's how I can do it. I can have the good guys confront the bad guys. It's night. Planes are overhead. The skies are lit up with lights. Big shootout and all that sort of thing. And so I figure, great. The only problem is I don't have any pencil and paper. I don't have anything. I'm in running shorts. This was in about 2000. It was right after 2011. I'm just in running shorts. So anyhow, I go up to the, 2001, I go up to the Lincoln Memorial, and I have a pretty good memory. I'll count the number of steps on each landing. I look around the top. I go behind the Statue of Abe. Yeah, there's a place somebody could hide. There's a door off to the right, a wooden door. I start to jiggle the door handle, and some cop comes over with his hands on his gun. He says,
yeah,
can I help
you,
sir?
What the hell are you doing?
I said, hey, this was a few months after 9/11. So I said, well, I'm a writer. I tried to do some research here. Man, he gave me a look, and I figured, hey, I don't even have ID. I better get the hell out of here and just take my notes in my mind before I get shipped off to God knows where, because that's what they were doing in those days. This was a pretty tough time in America if we think back and remember it. So anyhow, I went back to my office and quickly wrote down the notes and then put it into the Lincoln Memorial ending. But that's kind of back to your point. An editor can do that, can sort of stimulate you. And you have to think about what he said. He was a smart editor, and I took his words to listen to them.
But just think, if you would have been arrested for your art, that would have been a hell of a story, too.
Right. It would have been a hell of a good story. And John, if I could have smuggled it out of Guantanamo,
that would have been a hell of a story.
For it.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you what, Alan, we got about a minute left here in the show. So, again, like I give all the guests, I want to give you the last word to kind of let everybody know about your social media, where you might be at, and all that kind of fun stuff, and anything else that we didn't maybe have a chance to get to. So I will leave it in your hands now. It's all on you.
Thanks, John. Last word, it's Alan Topol, A-L-L-A-N-T-O-P-O-L. Go to alantopol.com. You look at the books or to Amazon, and I hope you'll pick out one of them that you want to try. They're all up on e-books. They're last four or five in paper. I hope you'll try one. And my last word is, please, if you read one, send me an email. I would, on my reader mail. I'd love to hear back from readers, please. That's what I'd like to hear. John, thanks so much for having me. I really, really appreciate it.
Oh, Alan, fabulous conversation. I want to thank you for coming on. It's been wonderful. Can't wait to see what you got going on in the future. Please keep us up to date so, you know, we can get you back on.
Sure will. You bet. I look forward to it. Next spring, I'll talk to you about the Italian divide.
Sounds good. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
So again, everybody, that is author Alan Topol. The book is called The Washington Lawyer. Make sure that you check that out. We want to thank all of our guests, and we want to, of course, thank all of our listeners for joining us however, wherever, whenever you listen to the show. You can find us all the time. Of course, if you just go to iTunes, you can subscribe to the podcast. You can get us directly to you. You can go to suspenseradionetwork.com to check out all the shows. We just had the Story Blender on last night, which was by Stephen James and Jose Castillo. Their guest was Tosca Lee. It was a fascinating conversation that they had. Make sure you check out all their past works. Beyond the Cover is going to be coming up on Monday. We just got word that on June the 1st, for Beyond the Cover, we are going to have best-selling author Nelson DeMille on. Make sure you don't miss that one either. Crime and Science Radio is going to be back coming up next Saturday, so you're going to make sure that you want to check them and everything that they got going on. Go to crimeandscienceradio.com. But everything's right there for you. The magazine's been released. We're very pleased with this issue. If you haven't got it, email me and let me know. We will send it out to you, and we want to thank you all again for joining us. We'll be back in about a month, I guess, now, for Suspense Radio Inside Edition. And we look forward to having you all there. But you can definitely check us all out. Stay on tune. Send us emails. Let us know what's going on. And we will see you all very soon, everybody. Enjoy.